the invitation and the warm hospitality. And John was kind enough to invite me 2 years ago, and so I'd been looking forward to it, various things, baby, sabbatical, et cetera, et cetera. So here I am now, and really it's been a wonderful day so far, and I also look forward to more times together in the coming days as well. So what I'd like to tell you about, I actually joined, as Daniel mentioned, I joined Illinois in 2002, and that's when I started getting familiar with flatland and two dimensions, because it's all flat. And then I realized that, you know, and I'd been around the mountains till then and thought it was really exciting, which it still is, but I realized that flatland and the world of two dimensions has its own charm and has all this beauty in it. And so that's one of the things that I wanted to share with you today. And in particular, what I wanted to share with you is the notion of fractional statistics that can actually occur in two dimensions, and particularly in the quantum Hall system. So we're all familiar with quantum statistics, and in some sense, it really governs the world and the universe we live in, be it from subatomic particles, the way elements are formed, Bose-Einstein condensates, the working of your transistor, all of it in a sense, or the stability of matter at room temperature. If we look at characteristic Fermi energies of materials here, they're about 10 times room temperature, which accounts for the stability of matter. So in some sense, quantum statistics, while microscopic, really governs the macroscopic world. So in two dimensions, so in three dimensions, as we all know, there's two possibilities. So there's, we're all familiar with fermions and bosons, and basically just looking at two particles under exchange tells you whether these are fermions or bosons, depending on the relative plus or minus sign. But as a result of something as simple as that, we have completely different behavior. Fermions versus bosons, as we know, have very, very different behavior. One is very friendly, bosonic, would all like to congregate in the same ground state if possible. On the other hand, at the other extreme, you have fermions, where Pauli's exclusion forbids the occupation of a state by more than one fermion. Okay, how about two dimensions, though? The two-dimensional world actually allows you to have something in between. And in principle, under exchange, it doesn't have to be just a plus or a minus sign. It can actually be a phase factor. So you have e to the I pi alpha. And so, for example, alpha equal to 0 would be a boson. Alpha equal to 1 would be a fermion. And now this thing can be anything in between. And so that's an anion. And so that's where the name really comes from. It was dubbed, I believe, by Frank Wilczek. And so these are the kind of outlandish particles that one can have in two dimensions. And what I have here is really an example of what I call an abelian, or what is called an abelian anion, where really you just pick up a phase. On the other hand, you can also have more interesting particles, which are non-abelian, in the sense of it's not just the phase that gets picked up, but you can actually, what really matters is braiding. So what really matters is the order in which these things are exchanged. So just like in a braid, you can create some kind of path, and even if you started off exactly where you ended up, you've done something totally non-trivial. So these are non-abelian anions, if you will. So now, the question is, where are these seen? And what are really signatures of these anions? Is there a way of really testing them in a realistic kind of setting? So this was a problem that I started thinking about almost a decade ago, and with collaborators. And it evolved on many different fronts. And so what I'd like to tell you was not just some of the initial ideas that that came about several years ago, but also where it's gone more recently. So basically what I'll be telling you about is giving you a little introduction of anions in the quantum Hall system, and then looking at really what has been done for testing quantum statistics. So what are the characteristic signatures that one looks at when you're looking at quantum statistics? And this actually goes back to ideas from the 50s by Hanbury, Brown, and Twiss, which I've shortened to HBT. So there they were looking, in a sense, effectively at the statistics of bosons when they were observing correlations in these radio telescope of light. And you can actually see the way the correlations play out such that it's very evident that light really is made of bosonic particles, namely photons. But the same kind of concepts are also used in modern-day quantum optics and beam splitters. So what I would like to ask here is, given the description that one has in the quantum Hall system, can some of these ideas actually be used, these Hanbury-Brown twist correlators, beam splitters, things like that that have been used for bosons and fermions, can these ideas actually be brought into the quantum Hall setting? So that's something that I'd like to discuss. And then finally, there's actually been a lot of activity and excitement in the realm of superconductors with respect to the realization of exotic particles that might have fractional statistics. And so one of the things that I'd like to show you is actually there's already been some experimental suggestion, quite a bit actually, that one might have these non-abelian particles. And so time permitting, what I'd like to do is to tell you a little bit about the ideas in the superconducting case as to how you can probe non-abelian statistics. Okay, so fractional particles in the quantum Hall system. So you're all familiar with the quantum Hall system, the fractional quantum Hall system. And basically, the quantum Hall system consists of a two-dimensional electron gas subject to a very high magnetic field. And one of the traits of the quantum Hall system is really the quantized, as the name suggests, quantized Hall conductance. So you're actually just looking at the Hall voltage versus the current. So if you look here, we have in here you have the quantized Hall resistance. Effectively, it's a similar thing. But the thing that's really interesting is while classically you would predict a straight line, you have certain filling fractions where you can actually have these quantized plateaus, and that's what corresponds to these quantum Hall states. And some of these states we understand reasonably well. On the other hand, there are other states that are still a mystery. What is the nature of the ground state wave function in these states? All that is still under debate for several of these quantum Hall states. But there are a few that are well understood, and the prediction there is that you would have quasi-particles that are so-called fractional in nature, and these are the ones that I'll be interested in here. Okay, so what does the quantum Hall system look like? And I will primarily be focusing on Laughlin states. Is that cut off, by the way, or that? Okay, if there's something too much at the bottom, I'll just read out what it says. But basically, as I told you, the quantum Hall system is really a two-dimensional electron gas. Interactions and disorder are important to understand the quantum Hall system. So it's really a very complicated problem. And the best that people can do is sort of effective descriptions for a lot of these states. The quantum Hall bulk itself, due to interactions, forms an incompressible fluid. And now, if you're looking at Laughlin states, where if you look at the ratio of electrons to magnetic flux piercing the system, that would be 1/(odd integer). So for every electron that you have, you might have associated with it an odd number of flux quanta. Now, if you look at the quantized Hall, so this is really the filling fraction. It's the ratio of the charge to the flux, basically. And if you look at the quantized conductance, it's just nu times E^2/h. And actually, it's very suggestive here. You could either look at this as, for example, an odd number of flux quanta, H over E, for an electron, Or you could look at it as a fractional charge, nu times e, for every flux quantum. So really, already in there is the notion of fractionalization with respect to fractional charge. Now, one of the things that happens in two dimensions, so in higher dimensions, in three dimensions, really, beyond that, I don't know, but if we're looking really at three dimensions, Fermi liquid theory does really well to capture the problem of electrons and interactions. On the other hand, and so effectively you can have a Fermi liquid-like state. On the other hand, if you go to lower dimensions, the effect of interactions becomes much more pronounced. So the phase space really for scattering becomes much larger. And as a result, you actually have a breakdown of Fermi liquid theory, and you really don't have these kind of fermionic excitations at all, particularly in the quantum Hall system. So what do these excitations really look like? In these Laughlin states, it's quite simple to understand. One way of thinking about it is just to do a Gedanken experiment where you could think of adiabatically passing a flux quantum through the system. And now when you do that, and you just use the fact that you have this quantized Hall conductance, you can look at the charge that actually congregates when you do this flux attachment, and you can prove to yourself that it's actually a fraction of the electron's charge. It's not really the electron charge itself. It's nu times e, where nu is that same filling fraction. Another thing you can do is actually see what happens when you take one of these quasiparticles around another, and you can show that it actually picks up a phase 2 pi times nu. And so from that, what you can actually conclude is that under exchange, these particles don't pick up a plus one or minus one like fermions and bosons. They actually pick up this phase that I'm telling you about. So they pick up the phase e to the I pi nu. And so really, the fraction that we're talking about is nu. OK, now let me just say a little bit more. For the first part of the talk, I will focus mainly on these abelian particles. But if time permits, I'll also get to the non-abelian particles. So just to give you a little bit of an idea, the nu equals 5 half state is something that's gained a lot of popularity recently. And one of its, if you look at the quasi-particle excitations, one of its signatures is that it's supposed to have a fractional charge of e over 4. And now carrying, if you look at the nature of these particles, they're supposed to be non-abelian in that this is really what happens under exchange. So we exchange two particles, one goes to 2, and then 2 goes to 1. But then what's very important is you also pick up this minus sign. And typically, you actually need a matrix to describe this whole kind of the different kinds of braiding operations that you have. So, so this is really the characteristic of what's called a Majorana mode. And in principle, the nu equals 5 halves should actually be hosting these kind of quasi-particles. Moreover, as I mentioned to you earlier, in the past few years, and there was a, for example, I think it was the March meeting, APS March meeting 2 years ago, where there was this first announcement of glimpsing this Majorana particle in the lab in the case of a topological superconductor. And if you went to that session in the March meeting, it was just absolutely swamped. You'd at best have to stand on your tippy toes to see what's going on. And then afterwards, BBC, this is actually what the BBC reported. Okay, I won't go into that story. That's a whole other story as to what's really going on. But there's been a lot of active interest in prospectively realizing these kind of Majorana modes in topological superconductors. And again, if I have a chance, I'll come back to that at the end. Okay, so another thing to mention is that, as I told you, the quantum Hall bulk itself is gapped out. But if you think of this, if you look at where all the action is happening, it's really on the edge. And if you want, you can think of the same analogy with the incompressible fluid. And the edge, on the other hand, can have these sort of long wavelength distortions, and that really is gapless, so that's what supports the gapless excitations. So if you look at the quantum Hall system, all the current at low energy is really carried by the edge, and that's also what's responsible for the quantized conductance, et cetera. And there's some very nice descriptions. In fact, much of it pioneered by Xiaogang, who's in the audience. And that's really a description, a Luttinger liquid description of the edge state for these fractional quantum Hall states. For example, this is for the Laughlin state here. Now, if you were to look at what a particle was, in some sense, in a very hand-wavy fashion, you can think of a quasi-particle as a sort of soliton built out of these harmonic modes. And if you look at the natural excitation that you'd write down, you can actually see that that does have fractional charge. Okay, so these are some of the predictions. And now the question is, has there been actually any test of this? And the answer is yes, there's been quite a lot of quite a few tests to see whether this is actually, first of all, whether the particles carry fractional charge. Fractional statistics, which is the topic of my talk, that's a slightly more involved thing. But fractional charge has been the first thing that's been tested. And now, how would you do this? So this, and the answer to that is actually by looking at Schott noise. What is Schott noise? Schott noise is really the noise coming from a beam of particles due to the fact that these particles might have some kind of graininess. So it could be bullets shooting off a wall, but a less violent example would just be if you were stuck in a hailstorm somewhere in the mountains and you had a tin roof and you had nothing better to do but you wanted to know the mass of the particles, the typical mass of the hailstones that were hitting your roof. What you could do is you could actually measure the current of hailstones that you have coming, and you could also measure the fluctuations. Now, the fluctuations, if you look at the fluctuations, so this is the zero frequency fluctuation, it actually turns out to be proportional to the amount of stuff coming through, so the current of particles that you have. And the proportionality constant at zero temperature is, in fact, whatever the quantum is. So for the hailstone, if they all have the same mass and you were measuring mass current, you would have mass sitting in here. On the other hand, for particles like for charge current, the thing that would be sitting here would be the charge of the carriers. So this is really Schott noise. There is noise coming at zero frequency, and it's really equal to the quantum that you have. So it could be the quantum of charge times whatever characteristic current there is. So the experiment that was proposed in the quantum Hall system was to take a Hall bar, and so this is a Hall bar here. And as I told you, you have an edge current going all the way around. And one thing you can, so then this is the top edge and this is the bottom edge. So you really have current going around like so. Now, one thing you can think of doing is actually bringing these really close together, so forming a pinch using using gates. And then you can look at the quasi-particle current that got backscattered like so. And now, if you look at that backscattered current, you can try to see whether it fits this sort of Schott noise form. So this was actively done by various groups, and this is still work that was quite a while back. But you can see, so this is actually experimental data, and you can see here that this is the noise, and then this is the backscattered current. Now, if you look at the slope here, it's quite linear. And if you look at the slope, it's clearly not E, the charge of the electron. It's actually charge E over 3. And this was for the nu equals 1/3 state. Now, if you look at some of the other stuff going on in here, you'll actually see it's linear at the beginning, and then it crosses over. That's because thermal effects start dominating. But even by looking at the scale at which you have crossover, it's when really E star V, is comparable to the current, to the temperature, and so in that sense, you can actually extract E star, the fractional charge. So all of this seems to be, and again, this is sort of the simple story that I'm presenting. There are still complications with really trying to pin down, is it really the fractional charge? Are there interactions between the charge that would kill these correlations, et cetera, et cetera? So there's a lot of mysteries that still remain. On the other hand, when these experiments were initially performed, and even now, it was really exciting to see that the charge quantum was really E over 3 or E over 5 for the nu equals 1/5 state, and not really, nowhere close to the electron's charge. Okay, so that was some evidence. And now, what about statistics? So obviously, there are signs of fractional charge. And now, what about statistics? Do these particles actually carry fractional statistics as well? So now, when this question first came to mind, one thought was to, why not go back historically and see what people did to test some kind of correlations that depended on statistics? And so really, as I told you, Hanbury-Brown, so by the way, Hanbury-Brown is one person and Twist is another person. I used to always get confused, is that three people, two, one? Okay, so this, and actually it's interesting, Hanbury-Brown was a British a radio astronomer, and he was employed quite a bit by the defense to use radar for tracking of planes and various things. But then that really honed his skills in radio astronomy, and then once he was off the hook with these kinds of things, he decided to turn these radio telescopes to the heavens and do other kinds of experiments. So this itself is quite an interesting experiment. So here, the basic idea is the following. You might have two sources, or it could even be one source, but you have a source of uncorrelated photons or electromagnetic waves. You can use either picture, and the results are consistent. And the idea here is that you look at intensity-intensity correlations between the two radio telescope detectors, and as a function of something characteristic, for example, it could be the separation, or it could be correlations in time, it should tell you something about the bosonic properties of photons. He originally did that to look at the angular diameter of stars, but you'll also see where the statistics comes into play. So the way he actually designed this was that he put these on two giant rails, and then they would get separated out, and that's how he would measure the intensity-intensity correlation as a function of distance. Okay, so now, if you look at quantum optics, modern-day quantum optics, it follows the same kind of principle. So if you look at this, it actually has two sources and then two detectors. And so now each of these photons could either just pass through this half-silvered mirror or get reflected. And now the idea is, if two of these came together, would they prefer both going into the same detector, or would they prefer separating off? And because these are bosons, the answer to that is that they'd both prefer going into the same detector. So if you look at this, basically what you really have is, if you look at the probability of one photon being detected here, if there's another photon being detected there, you can actually see that it depends not only on the joint probabilities, like so, but there's also an exchange term, which really comes from the fact that you have to symmetrize bosonic wave functions. And this exchange term actually tells you that both bosons or both photons prefer going into the same detector. Okay, and the same thing happens with two-particle correlation functions. So if you say, what is the probability? So this is this is bosons versus fermions. So you're just looking at the probability that two particles are at the same place at the same time, or maybe some distance apart. You can see that bosons like doing the bunching, so they'd all like to be, two of these particles would like to be at the same place, and then the correlation sort of decays out. On the other hand, for fermions, obviously you can't put two fermions in the same place, and so this is fermionic statistics, and you can see that the effect of statistics slowly dies off over some kind of decay scale that is set by some characteristic energy or length scale, be it, for example, for fermions, it may be a Fermi energy or a Fermi wave vector. And then the decay also happens with temperature. Okay, so if you look at what Hanbury, Brown, and Twist did, they actually did look at intensity correlations that had this kind of behavior. And actually, they got out the angular diameter of stars by looking at this sort of spacing. But the thing that one really has to notice is that there is this bunching behavior because of boson-like characteristics. Okay, so now where is this used? It's actually seen in a lot of different places. For example, you could look at correlations in a trapped gas of helium. So you can actually see that here you have, if these are bosons, you actually have this correlation. On the other hand, if you were to use fermions, you would have this sort of negative correlation. This also, as I said, it works in quantum optics. It also works in nuclear physics. If you look at scattering cross-sections, for example, if you were to scatter two identical particles, then you find that the scattering amplitude to scatter exactly at 90 degrees is zero. And the reason for that is that if these are for fermions, the reason for that is that you have these two possible paths. These are indistinguishable. And these paths come with a relative minus sign, and then these two exactly cancel each other. And as a result, 90 degrees is actually a special angle at which the scattering cross-section goes to zero. Okay, so now you can say, so you can see anion there as far as the quantum Hall system goes. What can you do? Now that we have these kinds of principles, what can you actually unearth in the quantum Hall system by using some of these principles? There have been a lot of proposals, and I will mention some of these. And this one, for example, comes the closest to what we were talking about. As I mentioned to you, the current in the quantum Hall system is carried by an edge state. And I showed you that example where you could actually have tunneling between edge states. So now, for example, you might imagine having a source of quasiparticles by setting an edge state to a voltage. And you might imagine partitioning the particles into two other edge states, so into two other edges. And that's what's going on here. And so now one thing you can look at is the correlations, the current correlations of the two tunneling events. And now based on whether they are anticorrelated or correlated, you can see whether they have bunching behavior like bosons or anti-bunching behavior like fermions. Another thing you can do, which tests both fractional charge and fractional statistics, is to do an Aronov-Bohm kind of measurement. So if you look here, these are two pinches. So the edge state can actually follow two different paths. The quasiparticle can either go like this, or it can go around like this. And so these two paths interfere, and you have Aronov-Bohm physics coming into play. If you look at the period of the Aronov-Bohm oscillation, that should actually go as h, Planck's constant, h over e star. And so you can actually get out what the charge, the fractional charge is by looking at the Aronov-Bohm period. In addition, if you put a quasiparticle in the middle, the one that's doing this loop will have to go around that quasiparticle. And so then you'll also have a phase shift coming from this abelian kind of statistics. So this is a way in which you can get both statistics and fractional charge at once by doing this kind of thing. And then finally, let me just say that if you want to look at non-abelian statistics, and all these have been actual proposals, I'll tell you a little bit about what's been measured. You could do the same thing. The only thing is, as I told you, these are Majorana particles, So it turns out that if the particle that's doing the loop encloses an odd number of particles, odd number of Majorana particles, that actually kills the interference pattern that's really coming from these non-abelian commutation rules. And so what you really expect is an odd even effect as you keep putting in more and more quasi-particles for the traveling particle to go around. So these are some of the proposals that have been out there. So what has been done experimentally? There have been actually a lot of attempts to look at things like correlation. The Mach-Zehnder interferometer is another similar, it's a similar concept. This proposal was actually pursued quite heavily in experiment. And at the moment, the answer is actually a little inconclusive. It's not at all clear as to whether they show distinct signatures of fractional statistics. So as far as the quantum Hall system goes, it seems like fractional charge has been fairly well measured. Fractional statistics still hasn't been conclusively measured. So that would be that still remains a challenge. So in the meanwhile, we were thinking of various other ways in which one could perhaps measure this kind of statistics. So I told you a little bit about the various kinds of things. One of the issues that I mentioned was that everything was using edge states. So one of the big questions that comes to mind is there actually a way of looking at the quantum Hall bulk and looking at correlations in the bulk, maybe something that can actually be measured? And so what I'd like to tell you about for a good part of in the next several, 15, 20 minutes or so, is to really focus on how fractional statistics actually gets manifest in the quantum Hall bulk. Okay, so now let's look at that. So one of the things that comes out of the quantum Hall physics is that what is the system? The system is electrons subject to, in two dimensions, subject to a magnetic field. It turns out that there's actually a mapping between fractional excitations in the quantum Hall bulk and anions in vacuum. So basically what you can do is instead of looking at the whole mess of electrons in the magnetic field plus these excitations, never mind the bulk and the underlying electrons, just focus on the features of the anionic excitations, and that's really the effective theory that one can have. So, for example, if you are looking at two particles in the bulk, two anions in the bulk, all you'd have to do is to look at the very simple quantum mechanical problem of putting two particles in a magnetic field in two dimensions. But these particles are no longer fermions or bosons. These particles are anions. So this is basically the problem that you have at hand. These are the two particles. They have this kind of anionic behavior. And now all you're looking at is really the quantum mechanics of these two particles in vacuum. So what I've done here is written the whole problem in terms of relative and center of mass coordinates. And ultimately, the problem is a really, really simple one, because most of us are familiar with solving this kind of problem. Okay, so a good part of the insight that I have actually just comes from looking at this very simple problem. So I won't go into too many details, but if there's anyone in the audience familiar with quantum optics, I should say that there's a complete parallel between looking at these states in the lowest Landau level and quantum optics. The reason for that is that, I should of course mention, when you have particles that are in a magnetic field in two dimensions, the problem breaks up into these Landau levels. And if you look at any of these levels, there's an infinite degeneracy. And in any of these levels, the problem really looks like a simple harmonic oscillator. So where is the analogy? The analogy actually with quantum optics is that the really interesting thing that happens in the lowest Landau level is that x and y, your two position operators, don't commute. It's very similar to photons, for example, in phase space. So if you're looking at x and p, position and momentum, those don't commute. And for, of course, for the photon, the uncertainty is related to Planck's constant. In this case, the uncertainty is related to the magnetic length, or sort of the cyclotron radius that you have. So you can, and since there's so much known about what goes on in quantum optics, you can actually borrow a lot from that language. So now the first question is, what is the description of two localized quasiparticles? If you go back to your quantum optics analogy, it's nothing but a coherent state. So if you look at a coherent state, that's the one that actually minimizes the uncertainty. So that's the one that has the least uncertainty in position and momentum for the optics case, and for the quantum Hall case, it would just be the least uncertainty in both x and y. Okay, so as I told you, this can actually be, if you look at the problem, it's very much like a simple harmonic oscillator, and if you look at the eigenstates, they actually correspond to angular momentum states that are actually centered around some arbitrary origin. And now you can actually build a superposition of states out of these centered around whatever place you want to localize your quasiparticle. So this is what I have for the center of mass coordinate. It's very much like the quantum optic case. For the relative coordinate, I have that phase factor coming due to the anion, and then that becomes a little more complicated. I won't go over that in detail, but there's actually a very beautiful algebra describing the operators for the anionic states themselves, and ultimately you can construct something very similar to coherent states that actually respects the exchange, the phase factor under exchange. So it turns out that actually the angular momentum states themselves are fractional, and then you can compose coherent states built out of that. Once you do that, you can actually, you're in a great position with respect to looking at correlations. So you can actually look at single particle propagators, but more importantly, you can look at these two particle propagators, and that's what tells you everything about the statistics. So that's what tells you, if I have two particles, what is the amplitude that particle one went from, say, some initial state to one final state in the presence of particle two? And all the information on statistics actually lies there. So you can, this is something very simple to work out based on the formalism that I already presented to you. And let me give you the answer. Let me give you the answer, and you can actually see where statistics comes into play. And you already saw, for example, in the scattering of fermions, 90 degrees was actually a special angle. It turns out to be the same in this case as well. So if you put two particles on a circle and asked, what is the probability that these two started off at diametrically opposite points and then went scattering at some angle theta, there's an expression for that. And if you were to look at just fermions and bosons in the lowest Landau level, you would actually see that it depended on two things. It depended, exactly as I showed you in that interferometer, it depends on the mutual statistics, and it also depends on the amount of flux that passed through the enclosed path. Now, if you look at what happens for anions, the same kind of thing happens, and you actually find that 90 degrees is special, like with the fermions, and there are zeros at some very specific locations. So this I'm plotting, this is the amplitude. This is the amplitude as a function of distance and as a function of angle. So you can see that 90 is actually a special angle at which you can have complete destructive interference. And that depends on two things. It depends exactly on the Aronov-Bohm phase going through the area and also a phase shift coming in from fractional statistics. So in some sense, this is really a signature that if you were able to measure something like this, you would actually be able to extract, again, both fractional charge, depending on the period of this oscillation, and also fractional statistics based on this offset here. Okay, and then again, you can see the bunching properties in a sort of more striking manner if you were to look at the probability of putting two particles at some distance r away. So density-density correlations, you can see that they go to zero as these come closer. So there's a sort of exclusion effect, like Pauli's exclusion. The only thing is it's not as pronounced. It follows some sort of power law, which can also be derived from Luttinger physics. Okay, so then finally, we can ask ourselves, can we actually look at bunching in a more apparent way? Can we actually, for example, simulate a beam splitter in the quantum Hall system? Okay, so this is where I'm headed now. And this will actually give you the final piece of the puzzle as far as anions in the quantum Hall bulk go. So again, let's go back to statistics. And again, this was just looking at very basic quantum mechanics or quantum statistics and saying, what are properties where statistics becomes apparent? Where can you measure bunching or anti-bunching behavior? There's something very simple. You can take two particles and ask what the average separation is and how these would compare to classical particles. So this is exactly what I have here. And so if I look at this, this is what I call a bunching parameter. So if I look at this, this is my average separation for quantum particles. And this is the average separation for classical particles in some kind of state. And now, if this is smaller than that, that means that particles like to come close together due to statistics. If this is greater, then that means they're more repulsive. So if this is a negative quantity, then particles are more boson-like. If this is a positive quantity, that means they're more fermion-like. So we can go back and look at the same quantity for the anions. And there's something very interesting. So I just plotted these for anions of different filling fraction. So now, for example, this one here is for fermions. You can see that the bunching parameter is always positive. On the other hand, you can look at bosons. The bosons are always negative, which goes to show you that fermions are always sort of, they have an exclusion kind of effect. On the other hand, bosons have an inclusion kind of effect. Obviously, the most interesting case is the anion. And you can see here that anions do something quite interesting. Let me take the one-third. They start off positive, and then they cross zero. They become negative, and then they sort of very far away. They're totally uncorrelated. They behave like classical particles. So this really goes to show you that very close, they're behaving more fermion-like. But as you take them further and further away, there's a sort of statistical attraction, so to speak, where they like to bunch up more. And so anions are actually, in that sense, schizophrenic in that they can act either like fermions or like bosons, depending on where in their life they really are. Okay, so now the question is, can you actually probe these kind of correlations? There's various settings in which one might be able to probe. One is just localizing bulk particles. And there's actually different groups. For example, Amir Jacobi, who's able to localize his group, who's able to localize particles in local minima of the quantum Hall potential. Lots of groups working on ed states. Another place where you might be able to see, where you can see correlations very easily is Bose-Einstein condensates. So people in cold atoms have some beautiful imaging techniques where they can actually make two copies of the same system and shift them a little bit and collapse them back. And that's a really nice way of looking at sort of correlations, two-particle kind of density-density correlations. Anions in BECs, however, is a whole other challenge in itself. So as a small, finally, what we were able to do was to ask ourselves, can we actually have a beam splitter in the quantum Hall system where you can move around these quasi-particles and see what they can do? So the setup that I showed you, the formalism that I showed you, by the way, someone thought I'm an experimentalist. No, I'm a theorist. So all the theory, I haven't, yes, all the theory behind what I'm presenting is what I do. I'm petrified of being in a lab, actually. So because I'm not very good with my, so I'll, never mind, I'm a theorist. Okay, so so theoretically, creating a beam splitter in the quantum Hall system that you can analytically solve is really hard. There is, however, one kind of potential that'll do the job for you, and that's really a saddle potential. And the reason for that, so this is a saddle potential, and for example, you could have x squared minus y squared, or this kind of thing, u, x times y. The reason that works really well is it's quadratic, and so you can actually incorporate that into the Hamiltonian that I showed you earlier, where you had particles in a magnetic field, and it's exactly soluble. So now, most importantly, it preserves the anion boundary condition that I showed you in the wave function. Okay, so I won't go into the details, but you can rewrite this Hamiltonian in terms of those simple harmonic oscillators that I showed you. And if you were to look at what happens, it's actually got very, very interesting dynamics. So take a single quasi-particle in one of those coherent type states, turn on a saddle potential, and see what happens to the dynamics. So if you didn't have any potential at all, these particles tend not to have dynamics. The reason is that you actually are projecting everything out to the same, onto the lowest Landau level. So in some sense, it's very massive. But the moment you actually turn on some kind of potential, you can get these particles to move. So a saddle potential would actually do the trick. And again, this is where we could appeal to quantum optics analogies. And it turns out that the saddle potential does the same thing as what is called squeezing for a squeezed state. So in quantum optics, what is a squeezed state? It's different from a coherent state. It still maintains the same quantum uncertainty, but it might actually reduce the uncertainty in one direction, and the price you pay for it is to actually flatten it out and make it more extended in the other direction. So that's really, and it turns out that the saddle potential plays the role of a squeezing operator, and if you look at the dynamics, the coherent state travels along the equipotentials. That's usually what happens when you apply some kind of potential in the lowest Landau level. Furthermore, it also gets flattened out like a pancake. And so this is how a coherent state would evolve. Now you can ask yourself, what happens when I actually put two of these particles? And basically, the saddle potential can act as a beam splitter. Because if you follow this, if you put these exactly along the separatrix, you can have two particles coming in. And now the question is, will they both go this way, or will one go this way and the other? So same question as fermions and bosons. So the answer to that actually lies in the bunching parameter. And it turns out that the answer depends on the initial condition. So remember I told you the bunching parameter, it changes sign depending on where these particles are. So now, if you turn on the saddle potential, and they were in the region where they actually felt fermion-like, then they would go off in opposite directions. On the other hand, if they were in the region where they felt boson-like initially, then they would both come together and go off together, and they would behave like bosons. So the signature of the anion is that depending on the initial condition, it can either act like a fermion or like a boson, and so that would be one further signature. So that gives you, hopefully, a little feel for what these abelian anions are doing. Do I have 5 or 10 minutes for the superconductor part? Okay, so what I'm going to do is sort of, and yeah, so now the question is, for example, what about non-abelian quasiparticles? This is something, for example, Chris has studied, but now, for example, can these be moved around? So let me now instead come to non-abelian statistics in superconductors, and in the interest of time, I'll just give you a brief glimpse of what can be done. So as I told you, this was a proposal I already showed you. There are all these various proposals in the quantum Hall system. And as I told you, in the nu equals 5 halves, these are Majorana modes, and they're carried by these E over 4 quasiparticles. Now, I alluded to topological superconductors. So for example, those that have the same pairing symmetry as superfluid helium-3, which is, for example, px plus ipy, specifically that state, it turns out that these can also support Majorana modes in their vortices. So these vortex degrees of freedom carry with them non-abelian statistics. So now the question is, can one actually use, I already told you some of the ideas that were there in the nu equals 5 halves quantum Hall case for looking at non-abelian statistics. Specifically, there was this kind of interferometry where you saw the odd even effect depending on how many quasiparticles you have in the bulk that are being encircled by the thing that's doing the transport. And as I mentioned, the answers in the experiment were not completely conclusive. There's some kind of evidence looking at noise and things, but you don't have these clear-cut interference patterns that turn on and off depending on this odd-even effect. So now our thought was, there's this wonderful system of topological superconductors that have just recently come. And in fact, all this particular question was motivated by my colleague Rafi Budakian, who many of you know, because he had done these exquisite experiments in strontium ruthenate rings. And it looked like, first of all, the one thing was that it's really in half quantum vortices that these particles are carried for these strontium ruthenate systems, or that's the prediction. So my colleague had actually seen some kind of evidence for these half quantum vortices, and so he really asked us, if these are half quantum vortices, is there anything you can do to show that they actually have non-abelian statistics? So then that got us thinking on some of these ideas. And so the first thing we did was to come back to the quantum Hall system and ask ourselves, is there an analog for the superconductor system that we can actually, can we come up with some kind of analog? So the answer to that is that in the superconducting system, in some sense, one needs to use a duality. What do I mean by that? A duality between charge and flux, really. So here, you have charge going around and doing interference. And the way you control the interference is through flux. It's the good old Arnold Bohm. On the other hand, in this case, I told you, the entities that are carrying these particles are vortices. So they're carrying flux. So is there some dual thing you can do to actually get some interference going? And the answer was actually, you really use duality. So in the Arnold Bohm case, you're taking charge along two paths and closing some flux. Now for the superconductor case, what you really can do is you can take flux around charge, and there's actually the same kind of phase factor that comes in, and this effect is called the Arnold-Kasher effect. So just like the Arnold-Bohm effect, it's picking up a geometric phase, which is sort of path independent. It just cares about how much charge you enclose, and you can see interference patterns coming from there. So let me skip the half quantum vortices, but let me just show you these were, let me skip the description of the half quantum vortices because it's a little complicated. But these were the kind of rings that Budakian's group was actually looking at. And what they were able to see was they were able to see the response to a magnetic field, and they could actually see little jumps in the magnetization that told you that there were flux quanta, and under certain conditions, these jumps would actually instead show half steps, which showed you that there were these fractional vortices. So now, because I'm really running out of time, let me just summarize sort of the basic physics behind what we thought we could do. So here, not we, but that can be done by experimentalists. And in fact, my colleagues actually, it was really a collaboration in that there was Rafi and Dale Van Harlingen and my group, and we all spoke together and sort of, it seemed like this would be a sort of neat next direction to go in. So here what you do, and I will just give you a quick description. Here you have current going through like this, and the loop that goes, and some of it gets backscattered, and then some of it gets backscattered this way. For the superconductor, here's what you could do. You have your superconducting ring, and in principle, at the center of the ring, you have a fractional vortex. Now, you can imagine driving a current through here, and that sets up what's called the Magnus force for vortices. So vortices actually want to go in the perpendicular direction. And so you can imagine another vortex coming this way, and in principle, it can go around this inner vortex, which is actually tethered to the center of the ring, either in this direction or in that direction, and that's the interference that you're doing. And then what you can do is if, in addition, you put some charge at the center with a quantum dot or something, you can control the charge, and so really the interference is governed by the Arnov-Kasher effect. And so that's really at the heart of our proposal, and let me just skip straight to it. So this is really the Arnov-Kasher effect that I mentioned, where you have flux going around charge. And then in addition, the central vortex, if it had this Majorana fermion in it, it could actually annul the interference pattern that you have because of coming from this other vortex going around. So basically, the proposal that we have is that as you keep changing the number, first of all, you should see a sort of interference pattern due to the Arnov-Kasher effect in the DIDV, or sort of the differential resistance across this, and that's actually been observed. And now the next thing is, if you could actually have a non-abelian vortex go around a non-abelian vortex, that kind of pattern should get killed. And so you see, again, this odd-even effect, depending on whether you have an odd or even number of these fractional vortices. So that's actually coming, more or less wrapping up what I have to say. So hopefully you've gotten some feel for what kind of things one can do with fractional statistics, how you can probe these abelian and non-abelian particles. And so my various collaborators on this, the bulk physics that we looked at in the quantum hall, this was really with my long-term collaborator, Deeptiman Sen, in the Indian Institute of Science, and my colleague, Mike Stone. The saddle potential was with Nigel Cooper. And then this very last part that I actually had to breeze through, we had these very dynamic young postdocs, Eitan and Babak, who have now gone on to become faculty in these two places. So with that, more or less, I'd like to summarize. There's hopefully I've given you a glimpse of the kinds of things one can do with fractional statistics, and now there's various proposals out there by various groups, and so now the real question is, what is it that will really show us the first definitive signature of fractional statistics? So thank you so much for your attention.
So we like to give students the first chance to ask questions.
So is there any analog to the spin statistics theorem for this type of statistics?
Okay, good. Yeah, so the immediate answer is actually no. In some sense, you would have to go do something beyond that. for looking at the two-dimensional case. Yeah.
All right. And I have another question. Fractional quantum Hall systems are known to exhibit topological order, right?
Right, right.
In this case, as if I'm not mistaken, you worked only on the infinite plane geometry.
At what?
You worked in the infinite plane geometry.
The integer.
Infinite plane.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. What happens if one treats this in the torus where I have degeneracy in the ground state? Is this going to affect the excitations and their fractional statistics and stuff like this?
Yeah, so this is a great question. So let me just say that in some sense, there are few signatures of topological order. And in some sense, one of them is a boundary. So in some sense, the edge state already is a reflection. Let me just comment that that is a reflection of topological order. The fractional excitations are also really coming out of that. So let me turn that question around, and let me actually say that if you look at the degeneracies on the torus, in some sense, they are reflecting the fractionalization in themselves. So if you look at the degeneracies there in the Laughlin state, for example, you can actually read off the E over 3, so to speak. So I actually haven't looked at exchange in the torus, and I suspect that as opposed to sort of killing some of these effects, there might be some really nice extra thing that comes out because of the degeneracies. So yeah, so that's a great question, and that's still open to exploration.
Any other student questions? Okay, then let's throw it open to questions from everybody.
So you talked about fractional statistics in two dimensions.
Right.
What happens in different numbers of dimensions, in 0 or 1 or greater than 3?
Okay. So, by the way, the one thing that's unique about 2D, actually, is compared to, let's say, 3D, the path that you took, right, is unique. So the system actually knows whether you went this way or that way, while in 3D, you can actually get out of that. So the only possibilities are things where the squared of the wave function really should be invariant. So then that tells you that it's either plus 1 or minus 1. In 1D, the problem is the concept of exchange is actually ill-defined, right? Because on the other hand, I mentioned the edge states to you. I already mentioned the edge states. And I told you how in the Luttinger picture you can write those operators. And in fact, even in 1D, you can really see the statistics coming out of that. So a lot of the calculations that I glossed over, but I mentioned, were done using edge states. And there, the only thing is you sort of had to jump at one point so the system really understood the concept of exchange. But even if you had just a boundary that closed in on itself, at least formally, you can see where the fractional statistics comes in. 4D, I don't know. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to comment on 4D? Okay, all right. So that's my answer to your question.
Next question. Okay, well, if there's no more questions, let's thank Smitha again.